The following message is brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. To learn more about the Ezra Institute's mission to advance the Lordship of Christ, please visit www.ezrainstitute.ca.
Welcome to another Holy Political Podcast. On this week's podcast, we give you the top stories of the past few weeks in just 30 seconds.
And we chat to Reverend Dr. Joe Boot about his big debate with John Stevens on how Christians should engage in politics.
So welcome to another Holy Political Podcast. I'm currently recording this from the comfort of my home. Where are you, Johnny?
Well, James, I'm literally wandering the corridors of power. You can probably hear the echo.
Have you lost your job?
Well, I don't think I have, but I was going to record this in my office because it's quite a good quiet place to record on the weekend. But my key won't work, so I don't think I've been sacked. But perhaps by the time this podcast goes out, my status will have changed. It feels very West Wing. I'm literally wandering the halls of power. I'm hoping to bump into Josh Lyman at any moment. So we'll find out. Hopefully by the time the podcast goes out, my status has been cleared up.
But you know what, Johnny? All is not lost, because if all else fails, you can apply for Universal Credit and then wait 6 weeks before you get your first payment. Hooray!
Well, and of course, if there's a delay, I can then call up the hotline and I'll be charged at 55p a minute, which of course is exactly what you need when you're struggling on welfare.
Yes, I must admit, I went on the radio just this past week to defend Universal Credit. And I certainly made the point that I think as a reform, is very necessary because of the whole question of making work pay, and the current system actually penalizes you if you get back into work, whereas the universal credit system, if it ever effectively works properly, will no longer do that because it's a tapered system. But that being said, I must admit, sure, Johnny, surely you agree with me that the 6 weeks and then the hotline, the helpline being charged at 55 pence per minute, that two pretty big own goals, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's insanity, isn't it? But I mean, people, the general sort of idea of universal credit is liked in that it sort of simplifies the system for the people receiving welfare, puts it into, you know, into fewer payments and into more streamlined system. But it just has not been implemented yet in a way that appears to be working at all.
Yeah. Tell our listeners the truth. Is the real reason that you are now wandering the corridors of power, unable to get into your office, because you actually told the wrong people of your criticisms of universal credit, and their heavy-handed response has been to ban you from your office? Is that what is really going on here?
Yeah, and Theresa, I'm actually running. Theresa May's minions are chasing me round and round the building at the moment. Yeah. As we speak.
You sound out of breath, so I can't work out if that's because you're actually running away or if it's just because you're unfit.
Thanks very much. You're very kind, as always. We should probably get on to the main event of the week.
We should
quite quickly. So in a minute, we're going to have an interview with Reverend Dr. Joe Boot. And we should explain why we're doing this. In the summer, some of you may have seen that following the Tim Farron resignation, there, you know, various people came out and commented on it and talked about the significance of his resignation. And one of those people was John Stevens, the head of the FIEC, the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. And he wrote in his very prominent blog that the response to this really should be that Christians embrace a liberal form of politics and embrace, as he put it, maximum freedom for everyone, not try to impose or argue for a sort of conservative Christian view of sexuality or any of those sort of other social policy areas, but rather to just argue for a liberal public square and argue particularly for individual freedoms, because that would protect the freedom to preach the gospel. Now, there are a number of responses to it. Probably the most prominent was from Joe Boot, theologian, who argued that actually Christians have a responsibility to promote laws and policies in line with the sort of Christian principles and frameworks found in the Bible. And this was a really fascinating little exchange. They've debated in the past as well. And so what we've done is we've approached both John and Joe, and we're delighted that they both agreed to do interviews this week. We've got Joe on, and we're hoping that all things going well, John will be able to come on a podcast next week and talk about his views. So This week we've got Joe, who talks from perhaps what you might call a more conservative view, though it's in, to give it more detail, it's really sort of about how Christian principles should be included in legislation that we seek. And then John, in a couple of weeks, he's from a more liberal standpoint.
Hey, Johnny. I've listened to the interview, obviously, and he really sticks the boot in.
I apologise for James. But before we do that, we should probably do a little quick recap of what's happened in the week. But we're a little bit pressed for time, James, so I thought what we'd do, rather than ramble on in our usual loquacious manner, we'd try and do a countdown-style quick
update. Do you even know what that word means?
Update on the last week in politics. So I'm going to start the countdown clock in a few seconds, and we'll bounce back and forth and see how much we can fit in 30 seconds. Are you ready, James? You got all your points you want to make in front of you?
I am so ready for this. Okay, bring it on. Start that clock.
Okay, let's go right. Oh, so it was a good week for Labour. First of all, Jeremy Corbyn probably had the best PMQs he's ever had, hammering Theresa May over welfare and about universal credit, and they then pushed a vote in Parliament on universal credit, which the Conservative Party actually withdrew from, decided not to vote on because they knew they would lose heavily.
Brexit.
And then the biggest story in probably world politics this week was in China, where Xi Jinping tightened his grip on power, becoming the most powerful and possibly permanent Chinese leader since Mao, which will have huge implications for the coming years, particularly with the way the US government is going, and has a real impact on human rights as they've deteriorated on Xi Jinping, and he's used soft power to crack down dissent inside and outside of China.
Brexit.
And the BBC marked 50 years since the passing of the Abortion Act by holding a debate programme on abortion, and also published some polling they'd done, which rather surprisingly perhaps showed the country is far more pro-life than many people expected. Also showed that younger people are generally less supportive of abortion than older people, and women are generally less supportive of abortion than men. And I think, James, that's a week.
Brexit.
Yeah. Brexit is very boring, isn't it?
It's not only very boring, but the government are in such trouble over the European Withdrawal Bill, the Great Repeal Bill, as it is otherwise known, that they really have, they've repealed their own repeal bill. Well, not quite, but in effect, they've had to withdraw it to make lots of changes to it, because Labour threatening to amend it so much that it basically becomes something completely different. And so they're in real trouble over this. And yes, it's becoming increasingly dull because we've not really made any progress and there's all this cat and mouse going on.
Brexit is... It is everywhere, James, and it is so boring. It's just so boring.
It's super boring. Nothing's happening on it. Do you know what, Johnny? I think until there's some meaningful progress, I think we should do what the guys on the Times podcast have done. We should have a klaxon that sounds any time one of us mentions Brexit.
Like a swear box for Brexit. Every time you say Brexit, you have to put 50p in the jar.
That's right.
So instead of when I next say Brexit, instead of hearing Brexit, you'll hear...
Yes, exactly. We should definitely do that. But I personally think, Johnny, it's time that we got to the main event, because let me tell you, this interview is just stunning. It's so, so interesting to get an experienced theologian who's clearly put a lot of thought into how it is our faith should interact with the public square. If you have any thoughts, any questions about what Dr. Boot says during his interview, then please get in touch with us. You can get in touch with us on Twitter or on Facebook. Email us at wholepolepodcast@gmail.com. This interview is brilliant, and you went to speak to him just a bit earlier on, didn't you, Johnny?
Yeah, I spoke to him the other night, and it was great. As I say, this is sort of, if you like, the first part of two interviews. This is Joe giving his side of the argument, and in a couple of weeks we'll have John Stevens giving his side of the argument. I chatted to Joe. He was very kind to speak to us from Canada, and here's what he had to say. And I'm delighted to be joined by Reverend Dr. Joe Boot. Joe is the founder of the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity in Canada and is a senior pastor of Westminster Chapel there as well. Joe, thanks so much for spending the time to chat to us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's go back to the big story that happened after the UK election with Tim Farron, perhaps the most prominent evangelical Christian in politics in the last few years in the UK. What did you make of the reaction there was to his views?
I wasn't surprised in the British political scene by the hostility that was expressed towards Tim Farron and the way in which the mainstream media went after him and kept trying to pin him on the sexuality issues. I don't think he handled his responses well, and I think in the end his resignation was about the fact that he lied to the British public about what his views were in the end. He caved in and actually lied. I think he, in the end, said something that he didn't really believe. But I wasn't surprised by the reaction to a Christian articulating their Christian beliefs in the public space. I'm not surprised they hounded him on that issue. I think what I was disappointed by was the fact that he was so inadequately prepared to address those questions by the church, by Christian leaders in the UK. That's a frustration to me, that he wasn't able to defend his Christian position and in the end just caved in to the pressure, and then for conscience reasons after the fact then decided to resign.
And one of the things that I was really struck by following his, particularly following his resignation, was a number of comment pieces were written by journalists, by prominent Christians, all coming out to defend him and defend his right to say what he said. But I think almost every article, the basis of the defense of him was liberalism. It was to say, well, if you're, liberalism says you can have whatever private views you want, but as long as it don't affect public policy, it doesn't matter what your private views are. From what you wrote in response to John Stevens, I'd imagine that wouldn't be your defense of why Tim has a right to express his views as a politician. But if you were to try and outline why he has a right as an evangelical Christian and a politician to express his views, where would you begin?
Well, first of all, historically, liberalism in the continental tradition and the British tradition does not mean that you have a right to your private views, but those can't be brought into the public space. That is a kind of radical bastardization, I should say, of liberalism. It's a kind of it's the sort of position of modern radical secularism that says you are allowed a set of private beliefs, but there is a public orthodoxy, and you must limit yourself as a political figure to the public, to the public orthodoxy of the secular state. So, first of all, I don't think any meaningful, in the historical sense of the term liberalism, I don't think any sort of defense of private belief over against public expression of that belief could be justified on the basis of historically what we call classical liberalism. I think that what was interesting, I think what the whole situation proved is that where I would begin with all of this in terms of a person's right to articulate their views is that there is no such thing as a neutral public space. Political sphere and the cultural sphere, which are obviously interrelated, are going to be governed by a certain worldview, a certain worldview perspective, a certain set of beliefs and convictions. Is going to dominate. There's nobody in political life, no politician, who is not governed by a particular philosophy, a particular worldview, and it's inescapable that those people will bring, because we are, human beings, we're integral beings, that we are going to bring who we are as people to bear in all of those aspects in our lives, in our family, in our home, in our communities, in our schools. And, people get elected to public office because of who they are. What made Tim Farron electable to his community in part was the fact that he was considered by his constituency a man of integrity, a man of conviction. And absolutely, Tim, just as anybody who may be an atheist or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim, is going to be influenced by a set of assumptions, a set of religious presuppositions that govern their thinking, that's going to influence what they think about morality, is going to influence what they think about political life and justice and social order, all of those things. It's simply an impossible feat to separate a person from their fundamental, most basic core convictions. And it was always an expectation in history of Western political thought that you elect a person and they bring who they are with all of those thoughts to bear on their office. Now, what we're dealing with now is a state, a radical secularist state orthodoxy that is basically saying there is only one set of views that are acceptable in the public space. You know, the notion that you can be what you want in your private closet, but you can't ever bring who you are to the table politically is a nonsense. Everybody is doing that all of the time. What we're finding is simply that certain views are now not being tolerated. And right now that is Christianity.
And so as we try to work out what a Christian approach to the public square is and to law and order, to politics, particularly as in this sort of mixed society, what are the key principles or places in the Bible to begin with examining?
Well, you know, you began by talking a little bit about that notion of liberalism or liberty, freedom, and people, to some degree, after this Fearon incident, beginning to discuss the issue of people's freedom and liberty to express their views and so forth, in private or in public and so on. And I think one of the interesting things to reflect on is that the Bible does tell us that it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. You know, if you think about the main narrative of the Bible, it is that actually through both the Old and the New Testament is the whole notion of slavery to freedom. I mean, this is the story of Israel in Egypt being delivered from slavery in a totalitarian environment of Egypt, where, you know, the head of state is a priest king, essentially, and the king's word is law, and there the people are oppressed, and God brings them out into freedom and liberty through the Exodus. That whole that narrative, if you like, is something that runs throughout the Bible. Jesus is the one who accomplishes our exodus for us at the cross from slavery to freedom. So if we want to think, and it's certainly been a big part of our political discourse in the West for generations, about the art of freedom, it's even there in our education, the liberal arts, and what does it mean to truly be free? We have to think about what is the end in view. Our culture is very good, our political culture is very good at talking about freedom and praising freedom and our freedoms and everything else. But the question is, freedom from what and to be what? Freedom is always to a purpose. In other words, the very idea of freedom that we use in modern political life already presupposes a teleology, that is a direction. And historically in the West, freedom was something that was understood to be freedom, didn't mean radical autonomy, which isn't freedom at all in the biblical sense, that's slavery. It meant freedom under God, freedom under God's lordship, under Christ's lordship and under his word. So freedom must always be related back to something. And that's the difference really between the Christian or, I think, scriptural idea of freedom over against really what we're laboring under today, which is the product of the French Revolution and the idea of liberty, equality and fraternity, which is radically individualistic. It's all about human autonomy. It's all about self-will. Whereas the Bible has in view relationships that our actions we're not simply isolated individuals who happen to make a contract together. We are relational beings in community, and that's what I think the Bible, both Old and New Testament, and if you think about God's law, both in the you know, Deuteronomy or Exodus, Leviticus, you look at the Proverbs, you look at the Gospels. What you see there is a concern for relational community under God, not radical autonomy. So I think the starting point for any sort of Christian political thought, and when Christians begin to think about political life, first of all, we have to remember that political life is another, or government, in this case, civil government, is only one of many different aspects of life, and civil government is only one aspect of government. Because there is, of course, the government of the family, and there's the government of the home, the government of the church. There's the government that takes place within the context of our work. And then there is civil government. The first principle for the Christian is, of course, Christ's lordship. and then the standards of God's law. So I think one of the best places to begin is exactly where Alfred the Great began hundreds of years ago in Britain, with the Ten Commandments, when he first began to codify English law. And that is why the Ten Commandments used to hang on the crown courts, of the walls of our crown courts in Britain. It's why they used to be displayed in our churches. There was an understanding that freedom and political liberty and social order begin with God, a community under God, and with the basic principles of his word. I think that's the starting point.
And you started to touch on there, you were talking about a freedom that had a teleology, had a direction. As you say, freedom is a word that's used a lot in a lot of different ways. It's bent in every direction. John Stevens, in his response to the Tim Farron situation, he was arguing for freedom in quite a different sense. I think he was talking about arguing for a liberal pluralism, which he said would allow people quote maximum personal freedom. Can you just unpack why you think that falls short of the biblical model?
Yeah, I think. First of all, I'm all for, as a Christian, I'm all for maximizing personal freedom. But that freedom has to be circumscribed. So, for example, if everybody has a radical kind of autonomous freedom, then I am not free to leave my belongings anywhere on display. I'm not free to leave my house unlocked. I'm not free to leave the keys in the car, etc., because somebody else might steal my belongings. So, you know, the notion of a sort of unfettered, uncircumscribed freedom is a nonsense, really, and it certainly never operated in any civilized social order. That freedom is not circumscribed by certain bounds. So the question then becomes, well, what is the boundary of our freedom? And as I say, the Christian gospel says it's for freedom that Christ has set us free. If the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. So the basis, the fundamental basis of Christian freedom is, first of all, of course, freedom from the power of sin and death. And actually, true freedom in the Christian vision of reality is freedom from the grip and the power of sin in our lives. What actually provides the boundary in the Christian worldview is the God's sovereignty, the lordship of Christ, and then his word, his moral law. So I think the difficulty with what John Stevens has articulated fundamentally is it falls into the problem of arbitrariness. So, for example, John has talked about in the past the common good. You know, we should all not be defending specifically a Christian view of society and civilization, but the common good. But, of course, that simply begs the question, just as, maximal freedom just begs the question, because the question is with respect to freedom. Okay, freedom from what and to be what? How is that defined? Well, that's going to be defined in terms of a religious worldview, be it secularism, humanism, Islam, Hinduism, or any other social order. And then the common good, of course, the question is, well, who defines the common good? And as soon as you start to define the common good, in other words, what is good for people outside of what God has said is good for people, well, then you're in a realm of radical autonomy again. And anywhere you draw the line with respect to freedom then just becomes essentially tyrannical, and it becomes arbitrary. And the essence of tyranny is arbitrariness. And so this is where it falls short. I'm all for maximal freedom under God. Which is the only ground of true freedom. And I'm all for the common good, because it's God who defines what the common good actually is. I mean, how am I in a position without God and his word to define what is truly good for people? So I just think it always brings us back to, by what standard? That becomes the fundamental question.
And does our approach start to change in a sort of more diverse society? It's often been said that the UK, at least in the past, has been a Christian country. should our approach change as it perhaps becomes more religiously diverse? And should the UK, being a Christian country, be something we should aspire to politically as well as in evangelism?
Well, I mean, obviously we have the... you know, the past that we can appeal to, the past, of course, centuries of custom and tradition and common law, the relationship of the monarchy to the church, and the oaths that have been taken for centuries by our monarchs, including our present monarch, who swore to uphold the law and gospel of Jesus Christ. So, yes, we have a long history and tradition. So when we think about defining Britishness or British values, which is part of the popular political conversation today, I don't see really how that can be done in any meaningful sense without a direct appeal to a Christian conception of social order. As for whether, you know, a diverse and increasingly diverse society changes any of these things, I think, you know, a couple of things are worth thinking about. First of all, when God gave his law to Israel, Deuteronomy makes clear, actually, that that Israel was meant to be a beacon on a hill. It was to be an example to all the pagan nations around. And in fact, I think it's Deuteronomy 4, maybe Deuteronomy 8, going from memory here. But in Deuteronomy, we are told that the question for the surrounding nations is, who has laws like these laws? Who has a God like this God, who gives a law that is so wise, and that actually the nations would look at Israel and that would be the pattern to follow? And I think the ministry of the prophets of the Old Testament to the non-believing nations around becomes incomprehensible if we don't think that God's word and God's idea of the common good applies to all people, whatever kind of societal background they may have come from. So, for example, Nineveh, the heart of the Assyrian Empire, Jonah goes there. Those people are not recipients of God's law word in terms of its codified form on tablets of stone. But nonetheless, they are called to account in terms of the standards of God's law, and they repent. Amos prophesies about concerning the pagan nations around and holds them to the standards of God's law. In fact, even the Canaanites were dispossessed by the Israelites because of their sin and violation of God's law. And perhaps one of the best examples of a believer, of a covenant, of somebody of inside of the covenant of grace, in a... one could argue a hostile cultural environment, was Daniel and his friends. And what we see there is Daniel being in political leadership, as we saw with Joseph in Egypt. And Daniel in political leadership there actually sees the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar and the laws of the land of Babylon, which is a miracle in itself, are actually altered because of the impact of Daniel. And the same thing happens with Darius, of course, and the Medo-Persian Empire. So that's the pattern we see throughout throughout the Bible. So I think that's one of the that's perhaps the first thing to be said about that. I think second of all, when we think about the impact of, you know, other cultures and so forth, the question becomes: well, do we want Britain to be governed by Sharia law and Islam? Do we want an Islamic social order? Is that for the common good? Do we want a Hindu social order with the caste system and so forth? Is that for the common good? Do we want a radically secular atheistic social order? Is that for the common good? And I think the Christian answer has to be no. So now that doesn't lead us to the conclusion that the Christian's task is to impose their view on everybody else. We have to compete in the public space, just as everybody else does, but we must do so in terms of a distinctly Christian perspective. And in many respects, we're the ones holding all the cards. That's the history of the nation. That is what God says in his word is for the common good. We perhaps can talk in a moment about the limits of the state and government and its function and so forth. But the Christian, surely, just like the Muslim, is going to engage and ask for a recognition of Sharia law, which has already happened in Britain. I think we've got some 85 Sharia courts now operating as a parallel legal system in Britain, which presents its own dangers. The Muslim isn't afraid of appealing to their religion, their basic fundamental presuppositions, their assumptions about reality, to be recognized in the public space. And I think Christians need to recover our courage that actually Jesus Christ is Lord. His word is true. His law is for our good and for our blessing and for the flourishing of all human beings, as it always was. And that can only ever be for the blessing of people and the common good when we live in terms of God's law for all creation and all of reality. And so, no, I don't think the fact that, you know, there are Hindus and Muslims and atheists living in Britain, that that means that Christians should change their attitude to what they want to see as the reality of socio-political life. Because if we love our neighbor, if we love God and love our neighbor, we will want them to know the blessings of what it means to live in terms of God's word and purpose, which is life and blessing.
And you, as you touched on there, there is then this question of what role politics, what role government within that. And in your response to John Stevens, you touched on the idea of sphere sovereignty. In fact, you talked earlier in this interview a little bit about that as well. Can you just unpack what sphere sovereignty is? And to what extent it limits the role of government and what we should be expecting government to do in pushing Christian values.
Yeah, so I think there's the two very quick things here then. First of all, as the backdrop to that, I think from a biblical point of view, a Christian point of view, there is an important distinction to be made in our thinking about these things between structure and direction. Structure concerns all of the reality of God's creation. God has established a variety of laws and a variety of norms from the beginning of creation. So, you know, very simply, obviously, we have physical laws like gravity. This is the faithfulness that's inherent in God's word for creation, that we see that kind of consistency. So God has established those kinds of laws, and he also establishes norms. So, for example, Jesus appeals to the very beginning of creation in his discussion about marriage. He doesn't say, well, you know, Roman and Greco-Roman culture right now, this is what we think marriage should look like. No, he says this is what it was from the beginning of creation. So those are the structures. And there are many structures within God's creation. And as history has unfolded, we see that there is the structure of the family. There's the first institution right there. The first structural institution that we can see right from the very beginning. We then see the notion of civil government, I think from around Genesis 9, many would argue, the beginnings of civil government, so the idea of the state. And of course, certainly from Abraham, some would argue from before, we have the beginnings of what we would call the church. So God has established these structures, and we can call those creational structures. And the structures in themselves are good. God's creation was good. In fact, he pronounced it very good on the sixth day. That's the structures, the norms, the laws that God has established. And then we have the direction. The directional issue is what's happened since the fall in the Christian worldview, which is that there are now two orders operative within the structure of God's creation. And that's the order of sin and rebellion and disobedience. And then the redemptive order, which is found in the covenant grace of God in the Lord Jesus Christ, where we live in terms of obedience. So there are many structures, but there are actually these two fundamental directions. And so as we think about political life and family and church and state and so forth, we need to recognize that God's creation and God's norms, these things are hold. They impinge upon every human being, God's creational order. But these two directions are at work. And so in political life, the reality of sin is at work. The distortion of God's order and norms are at work, just as in every other sphere of life. And the Christian task is to see the redemptive work, the redemptive power, the restorative life of Christ and of the gospel of redemption transforming all of those structures and norms. So it's the totality of creation. Now, the second principle then that becomes important, and I think these are really creational principles. I know the Bible doesn't use the term sphere sovereignty. It doesn't use the term Trinity either. But of course, we recognize that theological ideas are valid without necessarily the words being used. That God has established these spheres. We would recognize very easily, I think, as Christians, the sphere of the family and the sphere of the church and the sphere of the state. And sphere sovereignty basically means that these different spheres of life, whilst they are touching in that they do impact one another, no one sphere can swallow or dominate the others. And that is to say that under God, they have a delegated sovereignty in their own area. So the church can't tell me as a man, you know, how to run my family. Now, it might put me under church discipline if I'm not teaching my children the faith or beating my wife, and it has every right to do so. But that's the church's sphere or jurisdiction. And then, of course, the church and state separation, which is the idea not of the separation of the state or the church from God's authority, but the jurisdictions and the spheres of authority of the church and the state are limited and circumscribed, and therefore can't swallow each other. So we had the whole medieval conflict between church and state, which would swallow, which would dominate, which would order and structure the other. And so we have a distinction, a clear distinction between the jurisdictions of the family and the church and the state. And there are other spheres, of course, but those are the three primary ones. And that helps us to think, I believe, as Christians about political life, because where we are right now in the West is really we have an increasingly statist or totalitarian understanding of the role of government, of the role of the state, insofar as increasingly there's a sort of parts to whole kind of relationship where the modern state sees every other area of life as a sort of minor department of the public of the body politic, of the state. So the state thinks nothing now of redefining marriage, of interfering in the discipline of children by their parents. The only place the state would really have a role there within the notion of sphere sovereignty is if there was criminal activity going on in the family or in the church. So the modern state has started to swallow all of these spheres. It wants to regulate the church. It wants to regulate everything, actually, from medicine and education right through to what we're teaching our children, how we discipline our children, and increasingly what is permissible for the church and representatives of the church to say and do. So a Christian social order would actually maximize freedom by saying that the jurisdiction and role and function of the state is distinctly limited, as is the role of the church, as is the role of the family. That's the basic idea of sphere sovereignty. And in each of those spheres, Christians are seeking to be obedient to God and to bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, whether it's in our homes, in our churches, or in culture, which includes the political space, where we're also expected by God to be faithful to Christ and to the gospel.
Joe, I could quiz you about this all day, but you've already been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for those really fascinating insights on so many areas of how we can and or occasionally should avoid engaging in politics. Thanks so much, Joe.
It's my privilege. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, there we are. I mean, thank you so much to Joe Boot for giving us the time all the way from Canada and speaking so clearly about the points of view he was articulating. I don't know about you, Johnny, but I sort of feel after listening to that I need to go away into a dark room with a cup of coffee and just think about what he said and really, really process it. I mean, I know you're probably in a dark room now, in a slough of despond, your job situation, but, you know, I thought one of the really interesting things was he talked there about freedom, and that gets to the heart of the difference between the two views, because on the one hand, either we say that everyone should have the freedom to live out their life according to their beliefs in the public square as well. So not just privately, but also having a knock-on effect into the public square, because most people would agree that every belief system will make itself public in various guises. And then on the other hand, saying, but you cannot create such a space. You cannot create a truly pluralistic society when you've got all of these competing viewpoints, many of which don't start with the God who has made everything. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. It's that relationship between God and his creation and what impact that should then have on the kind of society we should be seeking, the kind of society we should be creating in terms of freedom, that I thought Joel was very, very compelling on, because I think it is a challenge to anyone who claims we want a pluralist society. But that's fine. But how do you explain exactly what the freedom you're advocating for is? Because as Joel says, it's freedom from something. And it's freedom to something else. And that's not always been very well defined in the pluralist argument. I also thought his point about liberalism, what is liberalism, and the as he called it, the bastardization of liberalism in its current form. Again, I found it absolutely fascinating that liberalism has never been, as it currently is talked about now, this idea of a sort of a free-for-all when it comes to beliefs. But there's always been that understanding historically when it comes to liberalism, that people bring with them to public office their own beliefs systems, their own set of ideas. And then when he raised that question of, well, what kind of society do we want? Do we want Sharia law? Do we want a Hindu society with the caste system? And what does that mean? And how, as a Christian, do we respond? I mean, I can only agree with him in saying, no, we don't want that. Not as a Christian, how could I ever sign myself up to that? So at the moment, I've got more questions going around in my mind than answers, but I thought it was a compelling argument. Whatever I ultimately decide on this, whatever our listeners decide, I thought he made a very powerful case indeed.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing what John Stevens says on a couple of those things, particularly as you said there in your first point, those issues are firstly of freedom and then of sort of what a neutral or plural state looks like. Because I think those two are very important, because we don't believe in, no one really believes in complete freedom. You know, very few people are actual anarchists. They believe in a sort of structure of freedoms that allows people to live out their lives for the common good, to have a flourishing life. And again, those things are things which you do have to define. And, you know, we have laws to stop crime and so on. That impinges on freedom. So I think he's right to point out that our definition of freedom is very important. And then secondly, this idea of can you have a neutral public square? Can you act in a way in politics and in the public square which is just a sort of neutral, secular in the traditional sense of the word, way? Or is every policy, is every law informed ultimately by some sort of worldview, some sort of ideology? Everyone is biased. And I'd be really interested to hear what John Stevens has said on this, because this is, again, this is one of those examples of why Christians can hold to exactly the same theological beliefs, but apply them very differently in the public square.
I thought the other point that he made about spheres of sovereignty, and quite rightly pointing out that although that language is not found in the Bible, that, you know, neither is the Trinity, but we infer it, we draw it from the evidence within the text itself. And I thought this whole mention of the various creation institutions, such as marriage, for example, such as the family as well. I mean, you know, you've done a lot of work in this whole area of family policy, family-friendly policy. And just on that issue alone, the Christian worldview has a specific understanding of what the family is, of how it is made up, of what constitutes a family. And it locates the importance of that institution directly in the fact that it's something God has designed. And it then goes further and says that this isn't just an institution for Christians in the church, that the concept of the family is for the good of the whole of society. And again, I loved what he said about us holding all the cards, that we have a passionate, positive, pro-family vision of how society should be built that is drawn from the objective truth of the Word of God, that should give us a real confidence in looking to create policies that support the family. I mean, that's just one practical example, isn't it?
Yeah, and that idea of sphere sovereignty, I think, is very, again, very interesting in this whole area of how Christians can disagree on politics while agreeing on theology. And again, I'll be interested what John says on the role of government, because you can agree with all the sort of ideas of what makes up a good society, but disagree perhaps on how government fits into that. So you may want to say, well, our society should have these values and should prioritize these things and shouldn't elevate or allow these things. But how does government fit into that? Because you may disagree with a certain action, but not think that the strong arm of the state is the right way to stop it. Or you may agree with a certain pattern of life, but not think that it's actually helpful for it to be enforced or encouraged by government. So again, we're really interested how John unpacks that next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, as we mentioned already, we're very much hoping that we'll have John Stevens, the National Director for the FIEC, the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches, speaking to us on the next podcast and giving his side of this debate. There must be, I hope, loads of questions and ideas and thoughts that are coming into your heads. Perhaps like me, you just need a couple of weeks to think through that all, and then we're going to hit you with another dose of heavy theology in 2 weeks' time. But this gets to the heart. I mean, one of the things I loved about, you know, doing this with Joe and then doing 2 weeks with John is I think it gets to the heart of what this podcast is all about, which is seeking to think through how it is our faith and politics and policies interact and work together, and what kind of society are we aiming for. So if you have any thoughts and questions, please get in touch.
Please do, and please do send over any questions you'd like us to ask John, or perhaps questions you'd like us to discuss afterwards. We won't really get all of the questions in, but we'd love to feed in questions from you guys, the listeners. So tweet us, email us, ask us on Facebook, whatever you like. We'd love to be able to say to John, well, actually, we've had someone, you know, write in and say they want to hear this from you. That's something we really want to include more as we go forward. But I think that's it for this week, James, isn't it?
I think so. We certainly don't want to be talking about it, do you?
No, and I hope, no, Johnny, another, Johnny, another penny in the jar there, please.
That's right. Johnny, do you know what? I really hope that things work out. You get back into your office in the heart of the corridors of power on Monday morning.
Thank you.
I really hope that everything works. You know, just stay strong, okay, brother? Stay strong, yeah?
I'm trying to. I'm surrounded by locked doors, and downstairs there are security guards with guns, so I'm relatively on edge. But Hopefully I'm all right. And by the time you guys are listening to this podcast, I have got out safely and have retained my job. But none of that is at all certain at this point.
No. Well, I mean, there are lots of unknown unknowns, and there are known unknowns, and there are unknown known knowns. And then there are knowns that are not known that are known. So I think amidst all of that, all I can say is thank you.
Yeah, well, as always, James, you've really clarified the issue there, so thank you very much. And again, do get in touch with us on Facebook, on Twitter, or anywhere to let us know your thoughts, let us know how you want us to change the podcast, any questions you've got for John, or generally going forward, any ideas you've got for future podcasts. We really want to make this listener-driven as much as possible. So thanks again so much for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to this message brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. Please feel free to share it with friends, but do not charge for or alter the material in any way without the express written consent of the EICC. Thank you.